So several times in my life I've given talks after dinner. This is the first time I've ever given a talk after the farewell banquet. So thank you all for coming. Let's see. So what I want to do today is to talk about a couple of different things. There'll be a couple of themes. One is that I want to talk about optimization principles as they might apply to the nervous system. And there are two reasons for trying to think about the nervous system in terms of optimization principles. One is that there are actually situations in which the performance of the nervous system is, in a particular quantifiable sense, close to being optimal. And we'll talk about some examples of that. The other reason is that even if the nervous system's not performing optimally, what thinking in terms of optimization principles forces you to do is to say something about what problem it could be the whole brain, or it could be a cell, or it could be some small piece of the brain. So let's say the system is solving. And also, thinking about what are the constraints. So instead of trying to view the nervous system as a large collection of components that are all connected to each other and almost coincidentally happen to manage to do something, you want to take the exact opposite point of view, which is to say that the nervous system is a machine that's been built or selected by evolution or shaped during the process of development and learning to solve certain problems. And inevitably, the nervous system is better at solving some problems than others. Right? The brain's not a general purpose computer. So we'd like to say something about whether there's a class of problems that the nervous system's really good at solving, and then maybe asking ourselves what it would take to solve those problems optimally at least organizes our thinking about what kinds of mechanisms to look for in the system. So I hope to convince you that that process is useful, even if not every system is going to be optimized. So that's one thing. Another thing is that I would like to take a certain amount of time doing something that physicists always like to do, which is trying to focus on simple examples. So one of the great difficulties of thinking about the nervous system is that it is, of course, immensely complicated. And it isn't completely clear whether we can find simple examples of general phenomena. So what we're going to try and do is to take, and simple, of course, probably should be in quotes. I mean, by the time an animal has, if you want simple, you should study bacteria. Right? In fact, actually, if you think about it from the general point of view of a physicist, right, to first approximation, life on Earth doesn't exist. To second approximation, life on Earth is bacteria. So to study these animals that get up and walk around and have brains, you really need an excuse, right? It's not a general phenomenon. So what we'd like to try and do is to look through the animal kingdom and ask ourselves whether there might be places that would be easier to get at some of the issues involved than, you know, the primate cortex. There's, of course, in physics, we have a strong belief in universality that, for example, if you think about the problem of high temperature superconductivity, if anybody seriously believed that every different high-temperature superconductor worked differently, then it wouldn't be the problem that it is, right? I mean, there's this firm belief that you're talking about a class of phenomena and that there's one explanation. Modulo details, right? So, I mean, it's sort of, I mean, I don't, if there are any chemists in the room, I apologize, but, you know, in some sense, in chemistry, you would try to amplify all the differences in the materials as being the really interesting thing. As a physicist, you would say, no, what I want to understand is the behavior of the class of materials. Right? It isn't clear in biology whether you can do this, right? We know that there's tremendous universality at the molecular level. The potassium channels that we have in the neurons in our head are not all that different than those in the septate ganglion of a worm, right? Which is a kind of sobering thought. But, evidently, we do something different with them. So it's not clear whether there are simple examples or not, but I think it's worth remembering that, in fact, most of the conceptual advances that have been made in neurobiology have resulted from the study of relatively simple systems. So, for example, the whole concept of measuring receptive fields in the visual system did not start with Hubel and Wiesel in 1961. It started with Hartline in 1938 when he was studying horseshoe crabs. Right. The idea of center surround organization begins with Barlow in the early 1950s studying frogs. Okay. So, and of course, you wouldn't have made much progress in understanding the action potential if you'd started out by trying to study action potentials in pyramidal neurons. It was a good thing that Hodgkin and Huxley chose the squid giant axon, and it was a good thing for the study of synapses that cats picked the neuromuscular junction in a frog, right? So finding the right simple system is an important part of the history. It's probably also worth pointing out, in fairness, that you know, this is true in the history of condensed matter physics too, right? So I don't know how many of you in the audience are condensed matter physicists, but you know, there are good old-fashioned BCS superconductors that don't have an isotope effect, right? So had the guys in the early 1950s decided to study the wrong superconductor, they would not have discovered that the critical temperature scales neatly with the mass of the ions, right? So the right simple example is an important thing. And then the other thing is, and this is really a sort of pedagogical point, it turns out that for a variety of reasons, the problems that we want to talk about have a natural formulation in terms of information theory. And so I want to give you some pedagogical background. We'll have to see a little bit what people know, what people don't know. But it's a set of, there's a set of ideas which are very beautiful, I think, particularly for physicists, and have turned out to be rather powerful in terms of trying to analyze how pieces of the nervous system are working. In particular, as you all know, information in the nervous system, as actually throughout biology, is represented in an encoded form. And information theory gives you a way of talking about the efficiency of a code or its quality in a variety of senses, which are much more precise than what people have typically done. And so it's very useful just as a practical matter. And then there's the more grand possibility that actually the optimization principles which are relevant for the function of the nervous system might be formulatable in information theoretic terms. So those are the themes that we'll go through. And rather than spending a long mathematical introduction, let me tell you some facts about one particular relatively simple nervous system where I think we can illustrate most of the ideas. So, you've heard a lot of lectures that relate to vision in the course, and I'll remind you that in what are amusingly called simple eyes, namely the ones like the one we have, the retina, of course, is in the back of the eye. You have a lens. And all of the photodetector cells, which are sitting back here, all look through the same lens. Okay. Now, there's another way to build an eye. It's called the compound eye. And that is that you take each of the photodetectors, and you give them each their own lens. Now, there's an obvious disadvantage to doing it this way, which is that the lenses are very small, which means that diffraction is a problem. Well, it's a problem for us too. The resolution of our visual system is ultimately limited by diffraction through the lens, and in fact, if you do the standard, the thing the astronomers would do, ask you, can you tell the difference between one point source and two separated point sources? And how far apart do the two point sources have to be before you can say that there are two of them? You get an angular separation, which is in fact very close to the width of the diffraction pattern coming through your lens. But if you want to do it like this, then the lenses are going to be a lot smaller and diffraction is going to be a much more serious problem. On the other hand, you'll notice, it doesn't bother us very much because we're fairly large animals, but you do realize that a design like this has a lot of empty space in it, right? There's all the space between the retina and the lens. Now, there's a class of animals that can't do this because they're so small that they would fit in the empty space. And these are the insects. So all insects, more generally all arthropods, the animals with jointed legs, have compound eyes. And I'll remind you that there are many more of them than there are of us. So the bad news is that this design limits the resolution, the spatial resolution, of the visual system quite dramatically. Is this actually working? Okay. Limits the spatial resolution of the visual system quite dramatically. But the good news is that all of your optics, instead of taking up several millimeters of empty space, now fits in a thin film that's 30 microns thick, which is an obvious advantage if you yourself are only a couple of millimeters long. So, insects. It's not clear because you have to tell me what the trade-off is for carrying around all the empty space. So, for example, if you're a fly, a significant fraction of the cost of seeing is carrying your visual system around. Right? Most of a fly's head is visual, and if he could get away without it, he would lighten his load noticeably. And so, taking off. Carrying this thing around is actually a substantial energetic cost. So you have to, if you wanted to ask, it's also true that these diverged. Our last common ancestor with the insects was 350 million years ago or so. So we're probably trapped in some fairly deep local minima by now, right? You can't just trade. Yeah.
Are there any other possibilities that you can find that?
Well, there are a variety of variations. There are intermediate things. For example, spiders have multiple simple eyes. A spider has about 8 eyes. So that's kind of weird, right? I mean, instead of making one big one, you've made several small ones, but the principle is actually the same as ours. There's a family of spiders that... So there's this problem when you do things in between physics and biology. Biology has all these nice stories to tell. And so every once in a while, you sort of cross over into just telling stories. So I'll do that in part because, you know, it's Saturday and it's a long day, right? But you understand, there's some serious business to do, but let's tell the story. So if you decide you're going to make lots of small, simple eyes, there's a problem, right? Which is that you have limited resolution because you've made small lenses. And actually, it's sort of worse than that because, I mean, in a simple eye, you form an image on the surface. You realize that in this scheme, as I'll explain more fully in a minute, there's basically one photodetector behind each lens. So each lens is just taking a small fraction of the visual world and focusing it down onto the detector. Now, if you try to build a small, simple eye, then you have very serious trade-offs between getting good spatial resolution and getting wide field of view. So you know that we actually suffer from some of this too, which is why we move our eyes around, right? We don't have uniform resolution. So there are spiders actually that suffer, well, it would appear have been driven to related solutions, except that rather than moving their eyes, they actually move the retina back and forth behind a fixed lens. So there's an enormous variety of solutions to these problems. So, you know, there's large-scale differences, and then there are small-scale differences like the one that I just described, right? We move our whole eye around. They don't move the lens because it's fixed in their body. So it's also true that in this scheme, there's endless variation. We'll talk about it later. So, I mean, this is a sort of physical fact about how you want to build an eye. But the reason that this is interesting is because, in fact, these animals like us don't just build an eye, they build a brain behind it. And so, if you look down on the eye of an insect, on the head of an insect, you have the lenses. You have photodetector cells, and then you have several layers of processing circuitry. Until finally you get to the back of the insect's head, and several things happen. Some of the signals end up going to what are called central brain areas. Which I might point out are not that large in an insect. And other stuff leaves the head and immediately goes for motor control. Now, one of the reasons that these systems are attractive is that, first of all, you have a fairly large amount of information about what these animals do with their visual system. So, can't be your stockbroker, it's Saturday. You have a fairly large amount of behavioral information about what these animals do with their visual systems. So, one of the most obvious things that they do, which is actually the thing that will occupy us the most, is they use visual information to steer. So an insect like a fly could fly along at a couple of meters per second. And like us, you need information from the external world to guide your path. In fact, if you're a fly, it's a little more serious. You actually need information from the external world to stabilize your path, right? Because the aerodynamics is not that kind to you. And so one of the things they do, just like we do, is to get a sense of how they're moving through the world from visual information, and then use that to guide their motor actions. And we'll talk a little more about that. It's also true that these animals do things that are, so we do that, and in fact, so do our primate cousins, and there are some things that, I mean, the classic example would be something like smooth pursuit eye movements, where if you're looking at something and it starts to move, you simply track it with your eyes, and right, it's motor output, and your input that's driving the behavior is entirely visual, right, or can be made entirely visual. So you have to measure with your visual system how things are moving, produce motor commands to, in this case, compensate that motion. But it's also true that these animals do all sorts of other things. The champions are probably bees, which can be trained to discriminate different patterns. They can learn to go through mazes using sort of abstract visual patterns at the different different branch points in the maze, and remember what order they're supposed to go through them in. They can generalize. It's really quite striking. Even flies, which are relatively stupid compared to bees, have the sort of spontaneous preference for looking at novel visual patterns, which is quite striking. So there's a bunch of stuff related to some form of pattern recognition, which I'm actually not going to talk about so much. And then there's, and clearly these things are learned and remembered and so forth. So insects are not little hardwired automata. They do actually learn quite a bit, in fact. And they also, as I said, use their visual system for guiding their flight, or walking also, but flying is more dramatic. Well, okay, so they have interesting behavior. So do lots of animals. In fact, I think it's reasonably obvious that big animals have more interesting behavior than these little things do. But the advantage of insects is that they're not that big. A big fly will have sitting in here in its whole visual brain 250,000 neurons altogether. Yeah. And 500 if you count both sides. And most of these neurons are laid out in a highly regular arrangement. In fact, it's essentially a lattice. If you look down on the head of a fly, for example, what you actually see is that these little lenses, for most of the visual field, are hexagonal. And they form an essentially perfect hexagonal lattice in the upper part of the visual field. Okay. And what's more impressive is that the cells under, when you look down on the lattice, you should imagine looking into the brain, and you'll find the cells arranged on the same lattice. And that's true of the photodetectors, which is not that surprising. It would be a good idea if you aligned your photodetectors with your lenses, right? Especially since the photodetectors are so small that they act as optical waveguides. So it's sort of important to get the tip of your optical fiber underneath the lens if you actually want to capture the light, right? So it's not that surprising that the photodetector cells are arranged in a regular lattice. What's more impressive is that underneath it, there's a region called the lamina, in which there are 12 different types of cells. The 12 different types of cells are actually packaged into little bundles called cartridges. And the cartridges are arrayed on the same regular hexagonal lattice as the photodetectors. Okay. This organization gets a little sloppier when you get to the next layer, which is called the medulla, which is a region of the brain in an insect where the density of neurons is almost an order of magnitude higher than the density of neurons in our brain. Again, gives you a little bit of pause. And then it turns out that by the time you're sort of done with all your visual processing, which is several layers, you sort of gather up the information in very large neurons. So if you look at the output of the visual system of an insect, in particular, the parts that are going to project down to guide motor control, you have a small number of very large neurons. So for example, in a dragonfly, right, dragonflies make their living by hunting small insects, smaller insects. Actually, some not so much smaller. It's pretty dramatic. But you know what dragonflies do, right? They sit there and they hover. It's already interesting, right? It's the mechanics of how you do this. And then they see something go by and they tear off after it and they eat it, right? And they come back. And if they're not done in 2 seconds, they try again. So that's a case where, you know, one of the things that comes up periodically is, what are the relevant timescales for behavior? Over what windows of time can you look at neural responses and things like this? In dragonfly, it's clear that, you know, every 100 millisecond epoch, he's doing something slightly different as he pursues pursues the animal. The information that a dragonfly has about a small visual target moving across his retina ultimately funnels down to, it is believed, approximately 20 rather large neurons that are sensitive to motion, small spots. And in fact, all of those things, you know that insects don't have backbones, right? That's the point. That's the class of animals that don't have backbones. So on the other hand, they do need to transmit signals over, for their bodies, relatively long distances. So they have these things called nerve connectives, where you bundle a bunch of things together, a bunch of axons together, protect them a little bit, right, as they go along. So if you think about the neck, that is to say the thing between the head and the central part of the body called the thorax, there's a little connective that contains these roughly 20 neurons. And in fact, you can dissect away the sheath that covers them and make an array of electrodes that wrap around the bundle of axons and record simultaneously from essentially all of those 20 neurons. Which means that you have access to all of the neurons which are relevant for the task of provide the visual information for steering the dragonfly as he chases the little spot. So if you're interested in coding by a population of neurons, this is a nice case where you know the population is of order 20, and you can record from order 20 neurons simultaneously. There are other examples. You can record from the photodetectors for, well, you can hold a single cell for the better part of an afternoon. And one of the important things is that when you record from photoreceptors in an insect, it's relatively easy to do it with essentially the whole insect intact. So when Boris Schreiman was here earlier, he talked about recordings from photoreceptor cells, which were, I look back at the transparencies, at least some of them were from toads. Typically what you do there is you actually cut out a piece of the retina and put it in a dish. And of course, a piece of retina in the dish is dying, right? And in fact, it's a little more serious than that, because in a vertebrate, in order to, you know, when the pigment captures a photon, it triggers a series of chemical reactions which end with the pigment molecule being disabled. And in order for it to be restored to its function, you have to involve another set of cells, which are in something called the pigment epithelium, which is essentially black because it's filled with pigment molecules. So of course, in order to do experiments on the photoreceptors, you peel this away. So this means that everything's running down in experiments on the vertebrate retina. That doesn't stop people from doing really gorgeous experiments, but it does limit the amount of time that you can spend studying a vertebrate retina. On the other hand, here, you can work with everything completely intact. Essentially, if you want to record from this cell, you make a small hole over here, bring your electrode in this way. And then that'll be stable for 4 hours, 5 hours. More dramatically, if you want to study these giant neurons that sort of collect information at the end of processing, some of them are sufficiently large and accessible that you can hold a single neuron for a week. You have to feed the insect. Otherwise, it doesn't do so well. But so you can record from the same neuron for a week. And in invertebrates, generally, neurons tend to come named and numbered. So in us, you would say that there are regions of the brain in which there are classes of neurons. And the region of the brain is, of course, reproducible from animal to animal. The numbers of different classes of neurons are reproducible from animal to animal. Some general facts about connectivity are reproducible, sort of statistical facts about connectivity. But there's no sense in which you can say that I was recording from neuron number 5,723 in this monkey, and I'd like to go find neuron number 5,723 in this other monkey. That just doesn't make any sense. Whereas in insects, you can do that. So that means that you can reproduce an experiment in a sense which you just can't in a vertebrate animal, right? You can go back to the same neuron in a different individual. So this combination of a long history of behavioral observations, extremely regular anatomy, and tremendous stability for physiological experiments gives you a lot of advantages. And so what I'm going to try and do is to tell you how some of these things have been exploited. And again, there's a real question about whether the principles that you learn or the conclusions you draw from studying a system like this are going to generalize to brains of very different design. And there are several positions one can take. One is, who cares, since there are actually more of these than there are of our kind, which I actually think is not an unreasonable position. Another point is that even if the answers are different, that is to say, the way in there's some sense in which, some clear senses in which the way in which the brain works are different, one of the things that working on a simple system can do for you is to help you sharpen the questions. So I think one of the things that's happened from studying simpler nervous systems is that you get very clear on what it was you wanted to know. And you can then go to a more complex situation and ask yourself, you know, can I do an experiment that addresses the same question? Because as it'll turn out, a lot of the things that we've learned from these relatively simple systems have required significant changes in the design of experiments in order to get to the answers. And then, of course, there's the possibility that some of the principles are more general, which is still an open question. So what I'd like to do is to take the example of the insect visual system and sort of work through with you a number of senses in which people have thought about the possibility that the system is optimized. And one of the nice things is that we can start in very physical terms. So how many of you realize that the Feynman lectures on physics, the undergraduate lectures, have two chapters about vision? Oh, very good, very good. How many of you remember what's in them? Ah, okay. Yes? So, that's interesting.
Could you repeat the question?
So the question is, when you say that the neurons are identifiable from individual to individual in the species, you might think that that would be more true for, let's say, the population of 20 neurons that form the output than it would be for the 250,000 neurons in here. So part of the point is that the 250,000 neurons in here are can be thought of, most of them can be thought of as 2,500 copies of 100 neurons, because you have 2,500 lenses. And as you go from one of these to another, they seem to be essentially identical with each other. There are a few differences which make perfect sense. Remember, an insect's eyes are, to first approximation, fixed in his head, which means that the photoreceptors that are looking this way see very different dynamics than the ones that are looking that way. So there are some specializations in processing circuitry at the extremes. But if you think about a sort of central patch, then what you have in here are many, many copies of the same collection of cell types. So in fact, those are named and numbered as well. And since this is a regular lattice, you could even give the lattice coordinates. Of that little piece, yes. By the way, the notion that that's not true in us is a bit more complicated than people give it credit for. So it's widely repeated that an essential feature of a nervous system like ours is that if one neuron dies, it doesn't make any difference. Depends which one, of course. If I kill one of the neurons in your fingertips, you won't feel anything in that spot. That's the end, right? So you should be a little careful. And you know, if you're not worried about losing a few neurons, look into a laser sometime. You don't want to lose those, because then you have a blind spot, right? Nothing you can do about it. So if you have a very regular topographic organization with not an overwhelming number of neurons per spot, then it's always true that if you lose one, you have a problem. I think it's also true, in fairness, that when people ask you, you know, when you lose neurons, why don't you see more dramatic deficits? I mean, part of the issue is how sophisticated an experiment you do. I mean, there's a trivial thing, you know, take an image. I mean, this is from the old days, right, when people argued about holographic memory storage, right? You take an image and you Fourier transform it, and you lose the phase of one of the Fourier components. And you transform back, and you know, it's kind of hard to notice, right? But it's missing, right? So if you make a careful enough measurement, you'll find that there's something wrong. It's just that you have enough sort of understanding of what images are supposed to look like that you seem to be able to fill it back in. So that's an example where, if you want, the redundancy resides in the problem, not in the solution. On the other hand, if you'd taken one pixel out, everybody could see that the pixel was black. So a small coordinate transformation can create the impression of robustness. But yes, in fact, one of the ways that you know that that there's a population of neurons here that are sensitive to visual motion and are involved in course control is that if you kill individual neurons, you have very specific deficits in behavior. Okay? So, yes?
Can you say something also about synchronization?
So, people are working on it, right? So, I mean, it looks like, for example, in the dragonfly, that synchrony between the different neurons is not a big effect. That's the way it goes, right? Maybe. Right. So now. Um, So these neurons are, I mean, they're not completely, they're layered, but of course, as in all other nervous systems, if you see a nice set of layers that feed forward from the receptors, there's always feedback pathways. And as in bigger animals, we don't know what they do, right? So if you go, I mean, you know the story, right? From the lateral geniculate nucleus to the visual cortex, right? There are more projections coming back down than going up. So from the lamina, which is the second layer, to the medulla, which is this place that's very dense, again, you have a massive back projection, the function of which is not completely clear, to say the least. Just given that most of you remember that there is something in Feynman lectures about physics, about vision, let's actually go through it. What's the first problem that an insect has in trying to build a visual system? He has to form an image on his retina, and he's chosen this peculiar way of doing it, which is that he has a head of a radius approximately R, and he decides to divide the world into pixels by building lenses whose dimension is approximately D. Now, linear dimension. Now, his angular resolution well, there's the pixel size, which is something like d over r, right, in radians. But then there's the problem, which is that he has diffraction through his lenses, which gives him an angular resolution of something like lambda over d, where lambda is the wavelength of the light that he's looking at. Well, clearly, if you make the pixels very big, you're not going to have very good angular resolution simply because you have not divided the world into many independent samples. On the other hand, if you make those samples too small, they become redundant with each other because the diffraction through the lens will blur the image before it's sampled. So presumably there's an optimum somewhere where these are approximately the same, which is to say D is approximately the geometric mean of the wavelength and the size of your head. So if you look in the Feynman lectures, he discusses the case of a bee, where he points out that if you do the calculation, you get it right within 10%. That is to say, the size of the lenses is within 10% of the prediction of this simple formula, which is not bad. So Feynman wasn't a great one for reading the literature. In the 1890s, a guy named Malik realized that there was a problem with diffraction through the lenses of insects, and realized that that essentially all the insects that you would see are going to have their visual resolution limited to about a degree. So it comes out that this angular resolution, let's call it delta phi, comes out about 1 degree at best. So this wasn't bad, right? I mean, if you understood that diffraction was a problem in the 1890s, you were doing pretty well in transferring your knowledge of physics to thinking about biology. But actually, in the early 1950s, Barlow, so Malik in the 1890s, was the one who realized that this was the number. Barlow, whom we'll meet several times in the lecture, in the 1950s, understood this optimization argument and did what a real biologist would do, which is he went into the drawers of the museums, the entomology museums in Cambridge, and found a whole bunch of insects with different sized heads, and plotted and then measured the dimensions of the lenses and plotted them as a function of the size of the head and found that they fit a square root law over a couple of decades. It's not bad. So at least there's something that makes good physical sense about how the visual system of these animals is built. Satisfying. Of course, there's a big problem, which, how many experimentalists are there in the room? Okay. So what's wrong with this argument? So you're in the lab, and you're trying to look at something under the microscope. Do you optimize your resolution always? No. Why not? What if it's dark? If you don't have enough photons, then it's not a good idea to use diffraction-limited optics. You should probably open up your apertures a little bit to trade away some spatial resolution in favor of being able to discriminate more intensity levels because you collect more photons. So this only works if you look at insects that fly during the day. Insects that fly at night open up their aperture. It's also true, of course, that if you're looking under a microscope and the things that you're looking at are moving really fast and you're taking pictures with a camera that has finite time resolution, it might not be worth it to optimize your spatial resolution because the combination of the velocity of motion of the object and your finite time resolution will cause blur, right? So there's, again, some trade-off that you don't want to go all the way to optimizing your angular resolution. So in fact, if you find this works even better if you restrict yourself to insects which fly in the daytime slowly. Right? Remember that as an insect, the dominant determinant of angular velocity across your retina is your own motion. Right? You fly at a couple of meters per second. If objects are nearby, they're tearing across your retina at hundreds of degrees per second. Okay. Now, this is a nice simple optimization argument, but we know that it has its limitations, light intensity, blur, and so on. And so there's a question of it's one thing to say, oh, it works out very nicely that animals that fly slowly in the day fit on this scaling relation, insects that fly rapidly or at night and do lots of acrobatics tend to have larger apertures. But, you know, can you do better than that? And so the idea is that at finite, that optimizing resolution is only the right thing to do at infinite photon flux. So if you have finite photon flux and finite time resolution, what should you optimize? So there are various ideas, one of which is that what you should optimize is the information that you gather about images. Right? Because the idea is that you have a trade-off between spatial resolution and intensity resolution. So in some way, you'd like to be able to count in the same units how much you gain by seeing things with finer spatial resolution, finer spatial detail, and being able to distinguish more gray levels. So how do you put those in the same units? Well, the argument is that what you should do is just count how many bits you've gained about the structure of the image that you're looking at. Okay. It's an interesting idea, and actually, it seems to work in that it sort of codifies the intuition that I just gave you about, you know, what happens if you fly at night or you fly very fast and so on in a semi-quantitative way. The problem is, or the plus, depending on how you think about it, is that the answer that you're going to get, suppose you say, okay, this is the principle, right? And we'll get to, in a little bit, how one actually computes this information. But the problem is that the amount of information you gather about images depends on the statistics of the images that you're looking at. Right? So obviously, if you live in a world where nothing varies very rapidly in space, then you absolutely should give up some of your spatial resolution in exchange for being able to distinguish more gray levels. On the other hand, if you live in a world filled with fine spatial detail, the trade-off might work differently. So once you realize that you're going to have to trade spatial versus intensity resolution, then whatever your principle is that tells you how you want to quantify the trade-off, in particular if you want to think of it in information theoretic terms, you have to tell me something about the statistics of the images. And that's a very important point, because it tells you that without doing any detailed calculations, if you start thinking about the nervous system as being, in some sense, optimized to solve various problems, almost always the right formulation of that optimization problem is going to have in it some hypotheses about the structure of the world that you live in. So a very simple example is if you're in the lab and you're trying to measure something, you know that in many cases, what you want to do is to average the signal that you're getting from your instrument over some period of time. Well, how do you choose that period of time? Well, of course, you know the answer, right? The reason you're averaging is to beat down the noise, and you shouldn't average for so long that you'll miss things. So when you set the averaging time, you're making use of two facts about the statistical structure of the signals that you're collecting. One is that the noise has a short correlation time, and the other is that the signal has a longer correlation time, but presumably not infinitely long, which is why you don't average forever. Okay? I mean, in many cases, the gap between the correlation time of the signal and the correlation time of the noise is so huge that you don't actually need to do this very carefully, right? If you average for 100 correlation times of the noise, you get a factor of 10 improvement in signal noise amplitude, and that's plenty, and the correlation time of the signal is so long that you don't have to worry. But in principle, what you're doing, even when you do something as simple as averaging, is you're making a hypothesis about the structure of the signal, and you're exploiting that to improve your computation or improve your detection. And so the same thing happens in all of these problems where you think, okay, maybe the nervous system is going to do a very good job at some particular task. The structure of the computation that it needs to do in order to solve that problem depends on the statistical structure of the world that you live in. So that's a very interesting idea, because it means that maybe part of the way that the nervous system is built is, as it were, in response to the structure of the world around us. And of course, we know empirically that some of that is true, because there are parts of our visual system or our auditory system that, for example, that don't wire themselves up according to some fixed rules, but rather respond and are shaped by input at least early in development, and to some extent continue to be shaped as you learn. So there's the idea in the background that maybe one can understand some of this as a matching of the computational and representational strategies of the nervous system to the structure of the world around us. And there's a very beautiful example of this that comes again from insect vision, which is the next thing you need to do in order to build a visual system is to choose what kinds of photoreceptors to build. So you know that we have four kinds, right? There are the rods which we use at night, and three cones that we use to get color vision during the day. And bees, for example, and their cousins also have three kinds of photopigments, much similar in many respects to our cones. And what we know is that if you look essentially across all animals, and you look at the absorption spectra of the pigment molecules in photoreceptors, they have very similar structures. So it would appear that when you want to design a photopigment, you don't have complete freedom. Okay? Exactly why this is in terms of the physics of the molecules is a long story, right? And actually pretty interesting, right? How do you, by using different protein environments, shape the absorption spectra of the pigments? But let's sort of take it for granted that when you build a visual system, you basically have a parts catalog, and in the parts catalog, you have visual pigments that, as a function of wavelength, have a certain absorption. And if you want to move this around, you move it around but keep the shape roughly the same. That's not exactly true. The absorption bands scale, right? So the absorption cross section as a function of wavelength, I think, looks something like, of course, it's really a function of frequency, and there's a characteristic frequency, and then things scale. So it's something like that. Okay? So this is empirically, you look at hundreds of visual pigments, and it turns out that if you shift them back so they all have their peak in the same place, then there's a very definite scaling you have to do to get their width. And that's it. It appears that you can't just make anything you want. Okay? So this means that all you can do is to pick your absorption maximum, and that's it. So that's your parts catalog. So now if you're a bee, how do you do it? Well, what's your visual task if you're a bee? In particular, what are you using your color vision for?
Distinguished flowers,
right. So what you do is, this of course isn't what bees do, but what you as a scientist do is you go out and you take lots of very careful spectral measurements on the light coming from flowers. So you go out where the bees forage and you do spectroscopy, right? And you find that different flowers are characterized by some light intensity, which is a function of wavelength, and of course is indexed by the identity of the flower. So what is the insect doing? What he's doing is he takes this function and he turns it into several signals. In fact, we know he has three. Let me just write this as sigma. Let's write it like that, okay? So every flower gets represented by three numbers. What the three numbers are depends on where he puts the pigments. So you measure lots of these spectral functions, and you ask yourself, where do I put the pigments? Where do I put my three lambda n's? So you go out and you measure from 1,000 different flowers, right? So you have 1,000 different sets of three numbers. And you can take those three numbers and change them by changing where you put the lambda n's. And obviously, if you choose the wrong lambda n's, then what you've done is to put your pigments in regions of the spectrum that don't actually differentiate among the flowers. Right? So, for example, the infrared is not a good place. Okay. Actually, what we call the visible isn't all that great either. It turns out you want to be biased to the ultraviolet. So you can clearly formulate an optimization problem, which is, how do I choose lambda n so that the set of Sn provide maximum discrimination of identity. And there are various ways of saying this precisely. I actually think that the formulation chosen in the original paper is not perfect, but I don't think it matters. So you do it numerically, right? I mean, you go out there and you, I mean, let's do something really simple, right? Let's take, take all of the flower, take all of the flowers, and if you take a certain set of lambda n's, you have three numbers for every flower, and then you ask, how close do two of them ever come? Yeah. So people have tried this. One idea is that if you take these functions that you measure as a function of wavelength and just do principal components analysis, you find that most of the variance is captured by three dimensions. It's not a bad idea. The problem is that what you don't know is the cost of building another type. Right? So I can tell you that most of the information is captured by three. But what would it be worth to you to get the extra bit that you'd get with four? So there's an interesting example. For those of us who live on land, or above the land, the dominant sources of color are the absorption properties of organic pigments. These are very broad, right, because they're big molecules. And so, right, you're talking about a transition between two electronic states, which are coupled to vibrational modes of the molecule. There's a dense spectrum of vibrational modes, and you have strong couplings, so you end up with very broad spectra. If you live in tropical waters, then one of the dominant sources of coloration is interference in the scales of the fish, which is why the colors of tropical fish are very vivid, even to us. But actually, they're vivid beyond what we can see, because we've only got three types. So we can't tell the difference between having very sharp spectral features and having very broad spectral features. But if you make your living hunting for tropical fish, it might be worth it to actually do this discrimination. So if you're a mantid shrimp, which has a sort of jet-propelled harpoon it's jet-propelled and its nose is harpoon-like, and it actually hunts for tropical fish. These are shrimp, right? They're like this. And if you keep them in a tank and you suddenly do something that convinces them that they should attack, they can actually break through a glass tank. It's stunning. But they make their living hunting tropical fish. They have 10 kinds of photoreceptors. And instead of just using the pigments, they actually build interference filters to sharpen their selectivity. So this is by way of arguing that your choice has something to do with the ecology of the signals that you have. But, I mean, these are extremes, right? Animals that live in places where the functions very slowly have two or three. Animals that live in places where the functions very, very rapidly have 10. It's not a quantitative theory. So anyhow, so you can imagine, for example, choosing your pigments by saying, what I'd like to do is to minimize confusion. Yeah? No, what they do is, like us, the only thing they have to work with are signals which are the photon flux weighted by the absorption cross-section. And then the parameters they have to play with are where they put the pigments. Yeah. Right? Absolutely. Yeah, but it, but this is all you have to work with. What you do with it's another story, but this is all you have to work with, right? So for example, we have invariance to illumination, and there's a whole bunch of complicated phenomena, but when you come right down to it, if you want to do discrimination, the signals have to be there in the cones. So you can imagine formulating a problem about optimizing your discrimination in a variety of different ways. So for example, you have 1,000 different types of flowers, you have 3 different signals, you just measure how close the 3 signals ever get to each other when you take different pairs of flowers, and you try and maximize that closest approach, which will be the biggest confusion, by choosing the wavelengths correctly. And what you find is that you get it right. That is to say, if you solve this optimization problem, then the places where you put the wavelengths are indeed where bees and their cousins put the pigments. So, I mean, if there was only one species of bee that you tried it on, you'd be suspicious. But it turns out that a whole whole collection of species that forage in similar places all use the same pigments. Yeah. Yeah, so those are the signals from the 3 classes of photoreceptors. Okay. So yes. So I actually don't know the answer. So the big issue is whether you rely only on the absorption spectra of your pigments, or whether you add extra things to serve as interference filters. And I believe some birds do these tricks with interference filters, but I don't know the details. Okay, so yes. Oh yes, sorry. Right. And as I say, there's some freedom. I mean, there's some issues exactly how you formulate the optimization problem. But I mean, what we could do is, right, you're trying to provide maximum discrimination power. So you have to tell me exactly what you mean by that. And as I say, there's some variation in the literature about how you do it. But it seems like it doesn't matter so much because everybody gets the same answers.
But it's finding
out the optimal lambda. Right. Sorry. Okay, so this is it's kind of a slow start, but I wanted to give you the idea that when we think about sort of how to build a visual system, on the one hand, there are very definite physical constraints. On the other hand, the world that we live in can force us to adopt certain strategies, right, if we expect to actually do a good job in that particular world. So what I want to do now is sort of shift gears and speed up a bit and think about actually, I mean, as you pointed out, this is a statement about the signals that you collect. What we'd like to do is talk about how you process them. And so what I'd like to do is to talk about a very particular task that insect visual systems solve, which is this problem of estimating motion. Yeah. So let me just tell you what the problem is, and then we'll take a break. Actually, let's take a break now. Enough amusement about flowers. Well, actually, there's something somebody brought up over the break, which is worth pointing out, which is that this optimization problem one thinks about as being the bees trying to optimize, or the bees being selected by evolution for their ability to discriminate amongst flowers, But of course, flowers are selected by evolution for the bee's ability to discriminate amongst them, right? So both partners have an interest here in getting this problem solved. So usually, one highlights the examples in evolution where the different creatures are competing, but this is one where they cooperate. And so it's of course not known how much of the evolution has occurred on the side of the bees and how much on the side of the flowers. Yeah. Okay, so let's talk about the problem of motion estimation in insect vision. Let me tell you a couple of facts. One is that insects can make purely vision-guided course corrections. So under normal conditions, insects are covered with mechanical sensors. It's like a high-priced airplane. And in particular, there are some which are sort of gyroscopic. Flies and their cousins one more bit of zoology, and then we'll do some physics again. Most insects have four wings. You may not have noticed this, but they have four wings. In certain species, like beetles, two of the front wings have been turned into the case that goes over the wings, like if you think of a ladybug, right? But in flies and their cousins, it's the back wings that have been specialized for something else, so they're not wings anymore. They're little sort of sticks with a ball on the end, and these things oscillate in the same rhythm as the wings beat. And of course, if you have something that's oscillating with a ball on the end, you have an inertial sensor. And so they can actually sense, although they can't have a vestibular system like ours because they're too small, they can sense rotational accelerations through these inertial sensors. And this, of course, is very fast. It's a mechanical sensor, and it's part of a feedback loop with the motor control. But nonetheless, there's a substantial amount of visual input to that system. And you can create conditions in the laboratory where it's clear that vision alone is guiding steering motions of the fly. The way you do this, well, most dramatically, the way you do it is to hang a fly from a torsion balance. So he can't actually rotate, but you can measure the torque that he produces. So he's hanging there basically from a stiff wire. And if you blow on him a little bit, he'll start flying. And if you then take your hand and move it in front of him, then he'll produce a torque to try to compensate the motion. The sign being such that he'll get the impression that he's flying straight. And if you want to, you can actually close the feedback loop. That is to say, you can take the torque signal that you measure and feed it back to the visual stimulus to create a sort of flight simulator for the fly. And under these conditions, he'll stabilize, say, just put a stripe on the screen, and he'll stabilize the stripe in front of him to give him the impression that he's flying toward it straight. Of course, it doesn't work perfectly. Eventually, sometimes he loses it, and then he'll get it back for a while. And so in that situation, right, he isn't undergoing any angular accelerations. He has no mechanical signals to tell him that he's rotating, because he's not. But the visual rotation drives the generation of a torque. So you know that he's capable of estimating something about visual motion and using that to drive his behavior. The other thing we know is that when flies are chasing each other, right, the signal that the leading fly has actually moved is again a visual signal. You might know something about your own motion through your mechanical sensors, but somebody else's motion you have to get visually. Then the time delay between in a chase between two flies, the time delay between the leading fly making a change in its course and the lagging fly initiating its turning response is 30 milliseconds. It's an extraordinarily short time. And we also know that in the back of the fly's head, you find a handful, say dozens, of large field motion-sensitive neurons. Obviously, there are components of the computation of motion which are very local, but at some point, this comes together into neurons that are sensitive to really large-scale motion. So if you want to know how you're moving relative to the world, obviously, when you rotate, it's hard for us because we tend to move our eyes to compensate. But when you rotate, the signals that you're getting over here and over here and over here are all coherent with each other. So if you want to know about your own global rotation, you should bring all of those signals together. And that happens in a handful of neurons in a very specific part of the insect brain. And if you kill individual ones of these neurons, then these experiments in the torsion balance fail in very specific ways. So there's a small number of neurons that are rather large that play an obligatory role in this process of estimating motion and eventually guiding the insect's flight. So, and these are the neurons from which one can record for very long periods of time. So, what do we want to do? Well, there are several problems here that are raised by the system. So one there's a problem of signal to noise. If you only have 30 milliseconds in which to respond and if you record from the motion sensitive neurons, the fastest you can ever get them to respond is maybe 15 milliseconds. Right? So you need to take a big signal that you start. It always takes 15 milliseconds to just get through the system. So some of this 30 milliseconds is just taken up with moving the signals around. Right? You don't really have it to play with. If you record from the photoreceptors and you ask yourself, well, what is the time scale on which the photodetectors themselves integrate? Some question as to whether that's exactly what you want to know, but we'll get to it in a second. They integrate for about 10 milliseconds. So if you want to think of the visual system of the insect as taking snapshots of the world, it gets one independent snapshot every 10 milliseconds or so. So that means that it's computing motion from, roughly speaking, two frames. Remember that he's looking out at the world through a collection of very small lenses. So his image of the world is very blurry. Okay, his resolution's limited to about a degree. It's much harder to see things moving when they're blurred, right? Because there are no features to attach to. The fact that you only have two frames means, of course, that you only get to count photons for this limited periods of time, right? So if you want to divide this into two frames, which are each 10 milliseconds long, then the number of photons you get to collect is however many you collect in 10 milliseconds. At sort of late afternoon, when there are still plenty of flies flying around, the maximum photon counting rates for the photodetector cells are perhaps 10 to the fifth per second. So this means that you get at most 1,000 photons in each photodetector. So you have maybe a part in 30 resolution. That's not so bad, but they can keep solving the problem as it gets a bit darker. So you can't average forever, and you're looking at very blurry signals. So there's a question then of how accurately you can actually solve this problem. Okay. And it might be that since you're trying to use this signal to guide your motion, that it would be advantageous if you could actually squeeze out all of the signal-to-noise ratio that's there. There's another problem. Which is the problem of coding the signals in the spike trains from these motion-sensitive neurons. In 30 milliseconds, these cells just can't produce that many spikes. So whatever information is conveyed about motion by the outputs of these neurons, it must be that small numbers of spikes are important. Just because there isn't time for there to be large numbers of spikes. So as you know, there's a long history of controversy in neuroscience about the relative importance of rate codes versus timing codes. And I think that, as I suspect Larry Abbott talked about when he was here, some of this is mired in just semantic confusion. But I think one thing that's very important is that when people talk about rate coding, rightly or wrongly, they conjure up an image where you have a time window with lots of spikes in it, and you get to compute the rate by averaging over that big window. So exactly what technical distinction you want to make between rate coding and time encoding, you don't have to agree on yet. But it's clear that in this system, that image of having lots of spikes to average over is just wrong. And so I would say that one of the issues so one of the points that emerged from thinking about this system, which I think actually is more general, is that you have to think about smaller numbers of spikes. Okay? So you shouldn't think of the spike train as being this thing that you see from the back of the room where you can't actually see on the relevant time scale, you can't actually see the individual spikes. That's not true. Whether the exact timing of each of them matters, and whether the times between them matter, and whether synchrony matters, and all this other stuff, those are all open questions. But it simply isn't true that the sort of natural time windows contain so many spikes that you can forget about their individuality. There's another problem, which again I think is a very general problem, and that's the problem of dynamic range. If you actually watch a fly flying around, a fly can fly straight, and actually it's pretty straight. So if you ask about the angular velocity that he experiences, so watch his trajectory and measure the rocking motions. And there's been lots of work, it's high-speed photography, right? You film these things and you measure this stuff, right? His RMS velocity could be 50 degrees per second. And the correlation time is something like 50, 60 milliseconds, maybe 100 milliseconds. So, he goes a few degrees off course and corrects, right? It's really a pretty straight flight. On the other hand, he can terminate this straight flight, with striking acrobatics. And during his acrobatic flight, he can hit the typical angular velocities are thousands of degrees per second. So you have to be able to estimate visual motion on the one hand, under conditions where for many seconds your typical signals are fluctuating plus or minus 50 degrees per second. And then all of a sudden you have to be able to switch over and build a system and have a system work with signals that are sort of 1.5 orders of magnitude larger than that in their dynamic range. So it's not only the sort of trite observation that, the visual system operates over 12 orders of magnitude in light intensity. That's not the problem here, and I think actually that's not the only problem in most sensory systems. It's not only that the sort of constant signal, the average signal, moves over many orders of magnitude. It's also the case that the dynamic range of the signal can change over orders of magnitude. So it's not only a matter of subtracting off a constant if you want to deal with this. So these are some of the issues that come up in trying to think about how the system works. And so let's see what actually happens. So So this is what you have to, well, let's redraw it. So let's think about signal to noise for a moment. And let's start not by looking at what the fly's brain does. Let's look at the signals that he has to work with in the photodetectors. So what's the physical limit to motion detection? So I'm going to give you a dimensional analysis argument and ask you to trust me that if you do the theory correctly, you get the dimensional analysis argument works, except for the number out in front, as always. So what I want to do is to ask you, if you're looking at the world and it moves a little bit, or actually you rotate relative to the world, and you've only got a certain amount of time to look, what's the smallest motion that you can actually detect? Okay? So the way we're going to do this is to ask, when I'm looking out at the world and it slips a little bit on my retina, how big are the signals that I actually get in each photodetector, and how big is the noise? Okay? So how big are the signals? Well, how do I want to measure? Let's measure how much, what I mean by the signal in one photodetector . Let me measure the change in photon count. So I have a whole array of photodetectors and the world slips a little bit. And what I want to know is if I look at a typical photodetector from one frame to the next, how much does the typical photon count change? Okay? So on average, I'm counting at some rate, and I get to count for some integration time. Right? So that's the average number. And presumably, the change is some fraction of that. Well, how big a fraction is it? Well, first of all, if the world is completely gray, then the number of photons that I count on average never changes. So there has to be a factor that expresses the maximum difference in light intensity between neighboring points, right? So this is called the contrast, right? So what's the typical scale of fractional changes in light intensity? So you're going to get a factor here, which is the contrast. And remember that you're looking through lenses of a certain size. So you mean the contrast as seen on that scale, right? The world has structure on many, many scales. So when I ask you what the contrast is, you have to tell me how big your detectors are. It's clear? Now, when things move, of course, I have an array of detectors. They're looking out through lenses that blur the image because of diffraction. So furthermore, I have a lattice. Now, the spacing of the lattice and the width of the diffraction pattern are the same within a factor of 2. So that's the same scale. And we're doing an order of magnitude argument here, so let's not worry about it. If the scale of the width of the diffraction spot gives me the smallest features that I can resolve, right? So that means that the contrast can't vary on a scale that can't go from maximum to minimum or over a scale C on a scale smaller than the width of the diffraction spot. So if things move by less than the width of the diffraction spot, then the maximum change in intensity that I can get is a fraction, right? So what I'm going to get here is delta phi, which is my angular displacement, divided by phi 0, which is the width of of the diffraction spot. Okay, so that's the typical signal that you'll encounter in one photodetector. Okay, let's call it delta N 1 because it's a difference in count. What's the noise? Well, the noise in one photodetector is just the photon counting noise, right? And since I have an average count of RT, R tau, the noise is just the square root of that. So let's call that delta N RMS. Well, what's the signal to noise ratio? Well, so that's the signal to noise ratio for one photodetector. But of course, I've got lots of photodetectors. And there's a coherent motion signal in all of them if I'm rigidly rotating. But the noise is photon shot noise and is independent in each one. So I get to multiply by the number of photodetectors. Okay? And of course, there's a number out in front that you can't get by doing this argument. Oh, because it's the square that you multiply by the number of photodetectors. If I don't take the square, I have to put the square root here, right? Right. The signal amplitudes add linearly. The noise variance adds linearly. So you factor this way. So what's attractive here is that if I go in the lab and do an experiment where I set the fly down, I put a pattern on the screen, and I move it by a little bit, I know all of these numbers. Because you can record from the photodetectors well enough that you can actually calibrate, under the conditions in the experiment, the rate at which they're counting photons. Okay? So you remember from Boris's lecture that photodetector cells can respond to single photons. That's true also in insects. Again, he gave you examples from the vertebrate. It's true also in insects. So what you do is you take the screen that you're using that's reasonably bright, you put a neutral density filter in front of it, you record from the photoreceptors, you put enough neutral density filter between the fly and the screen that the photon flux drops down to the point where you see the single photon responses. So now you know that at intensity 10 to the minus 3 of the normal intensity, the photon flux in one photodetector is 10 per second. So therefore, when you take the neutral density filter away, it's 10 to the fourth per second. Okay? So you know what the photon counting rate is. You certainly know the contrast because you put the images on the screen. The images fill up a certain area. The photodetectors form a regular lattice. So you know exactly how many of them are being stimulated. The optics of this system is incredibly well understood. And as I say, to do this right, you should take account both of the diffraction and the sampling by the lattice. By the way, I might as well tell you this. How do you measure the width of the, how do you measure the lattice spacing? Well, lattice spacing in degrees, right? So, well, you can think about doing a variety of things. One nice one, if a little crude, but works very well, is take a piece of fiber optics, cut a hole in the back of the fly's head, stick the fiber optics in the back of the fly's head, put a nice bright arc lamp in the other end of the fiber optic, point the fly at the wall. Right? You fill the head with light, it scatters around, terrible stuff, right? But the photoreceptors are optical waveguides. So eventually, the light gets captured by the optical waveguides and gets shot back out the lenses. And so you can measure the spacing on the wall. And by the way, you see a beautiful hexagonal pattern, which is one of the ways you know that it's a regular hexagonal lattice. And of course, measuring an angle on the wall when you're standing over here is not that hard. Okay, that's one way to do it. I'll tell you another way in a little bit. That's one you don't want to do too many times, but it is amusing. So we know all the numbers, right? That's kind of nice. And I told you that we know that the integration time is, well, can't be more than 30 milliseconds. The 30 milliseconds is a relevant time for the whole behavior. So the relevant integration times are presumably a little less than that. So maybe 10 milliseconds, something like that. A little bit of uncertainty there, but not much. So what we can do is to ask, what is delta phi at signal-to-noise ratio equals 1? And of course, the answer depends on exactly how we set up the experiment. But let me tell you about one set of experimental conditions. And what I should tell you is that before going into any more details, well, actually, let me tell you the answer here, and I'll take a pause for the... So, if the only problems that the fly had to deal with were diffraction, the structure of images in the world, and photon counting, then under some reasonable set of laboratory conditions, you should be able to discriminate motions of about 1/20th of a degree in 30 milliseconds.
SMR equals delta n one square over small delta. Small delta n is the square root of this upper one, right? So you get just delta n.
No, it's the square root only of this part, right? Yeah, so these things just become a right.
Why is the square root of this part and not of the whole thing?
Oh, because this is the typical difference from one frame to the next, which is a small number, whereas this is the background.
Okay.
Right, this is a back of the envelope calculation. You can do better, but okay. So the first interesting thing to note is that this number, as you might expect, if you sort of look through things here, is much smaller than either the width of the spot due to diffraction through the lens or than the spacing between photodetectors on the retina. So you have a regular lattice, and if you can make use of all of the signals that your photodetectors give you, you should be able to detect displacements which are about 1/20th of a lattice spacing. Now, one of the reasons this is interesting is that we do this too. There's a variety of phenomena which, in human vision, are called hyperacuity. Where you're able to resolve, in the visual system, it's specifically differences in displacement, which are very much smaller than either the diffraction limit through your lens or the lattice spacing on your retina. Now, this is not fundamentally mysterious, right? I mean, if you couldn't do this, then a noticeable fraction of modern microscopy and astronomy wouldn't work, right? So of course you can detect displacements which are smaller than the width of a diffraction pattern. But it did come as a bit of a shock back in the late 1800s when people discovered it, okay? And what's interesting here is that in the human visual system, what you realize, of course, is that it's something every microscopist knows, the width of the diffraction spot is not the limit to the displacements that you can resolve. It's the diffraction, you have to take the diffraction spot plus the noise level. And so here, we actually know something about the noise level, and what we conclude is that the system should be capable of this sort of hyperacuity task down by a factor of 10 or 20 below the nominal scale set by diffraction of the lattice spacing. So natural question is whether the system actually does this. So how do you tell? So, I told you that there are neurons that are sensitive to motion that you can record from for a long time, and actually my interest in this system was stimulated by getting to know somebody who did these kinds of experiments. I was a postdoc in Holland for a year and happened to have the office next door to Rob Gerater, who was at the time doing his thesis on this part of the fly's visual system. And like many physicists at the time, I thought that most experiments on the central nervous system were a big mess. The stuff on photoreceptors had already gotten to the point where it was really very beautiful. But when Rob showed me the kinds of things that you could do, and in particular this fact that you could record for a week, we decided that there ought to be some opportunities to answer some of the kinds of questions that we talked about over here. And well, for better or worse, we're still at it. It was a long time ago. So what's the experiment now to see whether you can actually do that? Well, again, you have a pattern on the screen. You have the fly sitting here and looking at it. So his eye is over here with the little lenses on it. I can't draw hexagons very well. He's looking at the screen, and you have an electrode in the back of his head, and you're recording from one of these particular motion-sensitive neurons, in particular one that's sensitive to horizontal motion. So the experiment's very simple. You take the pattern on the screen, and you give it a displacement as a function of time that just looks like this, or like that, and there's some delta theta. And then when you record from the neuron, well, the neuron occasionally produces a spike when nothing's moving, but it's rare. And the step of motion produces a little volley of action potentials. And we know that what's relevant is perhaps 40 milliseconds worth of data, because we know that the flies can actually turn in response to motion within 30 milliseconds. So something like this is the relevant window. And in that time, it's very rare that you get more than three spikes. Typically, you get two, one sometimes. And then the question of whether the system can really resolve small differences here is the question of whether when you look at this pattern of action potentials, you can tell me whether the motion on the screen was the small step or the big step. Okay? So conceptually, what you want to do is to describe the response in some way. We can discuss exactly how you do it in a second. And what we want to know is, what's the probability that the response arose from the small step versus the probability that that response arose from the large step? And conceptually, what you're hoping to see is something like this. If I could imagine putting the response along an axis, then maybe this would be the probability of the response given the small step, and this would be the probability of the response given the large step. And of course, then you all know what to do. If you're on this side, then your best guess is that it was the small step. If you're on that side, your best guess is it was the large step. And these are your errors. Right? And so the area in this part tells you the probability that you make a mistake. And of course, 1 minus that is the probability that you get it right. Okay? Yes?
The probability then assumes you're going to repeat this experiment many times?
So...
I mean, what I'm asking is why doesn't it repeat this?
Exactly. So let's be careful about this. This is the probability that you'll make a mistake when you're forced to make the discrimination having only seen one example of the response. Right? However, in order to figure that out, I need to know what these distributions look like. So I have to do many experiments to see what the distributions look like. But then when I ask you, can you make the discrimination, you have to make the discrimination on one example. Okay? So learning the rule takes a long time. But then when I test you, you only get one shot at it. Okay? That's very important.
So the fly has to remember something.
Well, so what we're doing here, right, so what we're doing here, of course, is we're asking about the quality of the signal that's represented in the neurons. We're not asking, can I actually train the fly to make this discrimination, right? So we're looking at the neuron as a device which has encoded the result of computing motion, and we're asking how well has that been done? It's a separate question, could the animal actually make this particular discrimination? So we're asking from the photoreceptors to here, how good is the system? So you can imagine describing the response in various ways. So one is you could take a window, a fixed window, and just count how many spikes you saw. So then response could just equal number of spikes. Another possibility is that you actually measure the time of the first spike, the time to the second spike, and so on. So it's a set of times. And actually, that's the one that gives you the thing closest to this picture. So suppose you just measure how long it takes for the first spike to appear, or alternatively, the time between the first two spikes. Then you get a picture that looks very much like this, where this axis is that time. And of course, it goes the other way. That is to say, large steps produce short intervals, or quick spikes. And so I've drawn it backwards. So so remember, well, that's a question in any psychophysical experiment, right? All psychophysical experiments that are claimed to be two alternative experiments have the problem that they're only two alternative if you assume that the animal knows all the things that you held constant. So here, we're asking, how well does this neuron represent the signal? So we're free to hold anything constant that we want, right? Because, for example, when I did this calculation, I didn't ask you, how do you know when the step occurred? So this calculation is on the assumption that you know when to look for the step. If you don't know when to look for the step, you have an extra problem. So here, if we agree that you know when to look for the step, I'm allowed to use this time interval. But hold on, but it's a problem, right? Which we'll get back to in just a second. So what we're doing here is we're taking a very stripped down view of the problem that the fly has. He lives in a world where there's only two possibilities and he has to tell the difference. And we're going to look at how well he can tell the difference as a measure of how accurately he's computed motion. But of course, that's not the natural situation. So we're going to get out of this in just a second. But let me finish the story. So, yes? To the amplitude, right? So you instantaneously move the pattern over. Okay, by either a small amount or a slightly larger amount. You could also have, if you wanted to, move to the right or the left, but to be perfectly honest, I don't remember why we just settled on this. But so another thing you could do is to take the times of arrival, And yet another thing you could do, which must be equivalent, is to take some finite time resolution and digitize the spike train and turn the response into some binary pattern. Right? So you could also take it to be binary patterns with some time window. Right? And then if you do this, you have two parameters, right? One is how finely you divide things, and of course, always there's a question of how long you are willing to look. So you can do all of these things, and of course, you know, because there's a lot of interest in questions like, do the times of arrivals of the spikes tell you something that the number of spikes don't and everything? It's actually interesting to go through all the details. But here, that's not the point. The point is that if you actually ask yourself, at what value of delta theta can you do this task and get it right 75% of the time, which is sort of signal-to-noise ratio of unity, the answer is, well, it's not quite 0.05 degrees. It's about 0.1 degree. So the delta theta, where the signal-to-noise ratio is about 1, is something like 0.1 degrees. So it's within times 2 of the physical limit. And let me remind you that what we're doing here is we're taking things that we know about the physical structure of the representation of signals in the photoreceptor cells. So it's a property of the input to the nervous system. We're then going to a neuron which is 4 layers deep into the nervous system and asking a very particular question about its response properties. I'm not asking what its firing rate is, right? I'm not asking exactly what the timing of the spikes is. I'm asking how accurately does it represent the motion? And the answer is that that is a number that within a factor of 2 we can get without making a model of the fly's visual system, but only by looking out at the physical signals that it has to work with at the input. Okay?
This neuron is one of these 20 that you
talked about? So the 20 is in the dragonfly. It's one of perhaps 50 in the fly that parcel out different components of the motion. No, that doesn't seem, I mean, you can try, but for the most part, they take independent pieces, you know, different projections. I don't know, maybe if you combine a few more, you could squeeze out the last factor of 2.
So you say that if you do the same experiment and they cost from 50 euros, only one of them you'll get this information, and the rest you just don't bother.
So I think it's the case that if you recorded from some of the other neurons in this same region of the brain, you might find that under these very reduced conditions, there's some redundancy. But not a huge amount.
So this is what you found, so you're sure you found the neuron which was best?
Right. Now, of course, what you always, if you find that you come close, if you find that your performance is close to optimal, then you never have to answer the question, what are the other neurons for? If you find that your performance is very bad, then there's always the question of whether it's just the signal's been distributed over many neurons and you haven't put them together in the right way. So yeah, for some reason, it's actually weird. The fly's visual system has sort of parceled out motion along horizontal and vertical to different neurons, which you sort of think, oh, that's obvious, right? Because, you know, doing this is different than doing that. But I'll remind you that the photodetectors are a hexagonal lattice. So if you're looking out at the world through a hexagonal lattice, then actually horizontal and vertical components are not particularly, one of them is probably unnatural. And it turns out it's the horizontal one, right? In order to figure out that something's moving in the horizontal direction, if you think, well, just look, compare your signals with your neighbor. But your neighbor is up there or down there on a hexagonal lattice. It's not over here. So the system actually has to go through some wiring to make sure that it actually computes the horizontal direction of motion. So for some reason, it decides to do this. probably related to the flight mechanics. But anyhow. So the problem with this, of course, is that it's a very restricted piece of the world. As I say, we've made a little world in which there are only two alternatives. So can we address the same kinds of questions in a more natural context? So what we'd like to do is something a little more like what the fly actually has to do. Namely, its angular velocity is a function of time. And it's getting a steady stream of output of spikes from its motion-sensitive neurons. And you'd like to ask, how accurately is this time-dependent signal represented in this spike train? Now, there are a variety of ways of doing that, but one that would certainly work would be if you could take the spike train and run it through some sort of decoder, which would give you back some estimate of what the velocity was continuously. And then you could just compare these and ask, how big are your errors? And how do those errors compare to this physical limit? Okay? So from this point of view, we'd like to decode the response of this neuron, not because we necessarily believe that the animal does precisely this decoding, although clearly he has to do something like this, because eventually he produces a torque, right? And we know that the torque more or less follows the velocity, right? That's how you build a control system. So he has to generate a continuous signal that's related to motion. The motion is encoded in this stream of spikes in some way, so he has to do something like this. He clearly doesn't have to reconstruct the velocity itself, right? That's not necessary, because what he has to produce is the motor commands to his muscles, right? But nonetheless, for our purposes, the reason we want to do this is essentially because we want to take the signal, which is in this encoded form, and get it back into the space where we understand what the level of precision ought to be. Okay? So we have an understanding of how accurate you can be in this space, but it's not clear how to translate that into, you know, how accurately should the spikes be placed in time or something like that. That's kind of a hard question. But it's easier if we could make the comparison here. So how are we actually going to do this? Well, so I don't know whether Larry talked a little bit about this or not, but there is a limit. This problem is in general very hard because the encoding is very nonlinear. So the process by which signals get turned into spikes is obviously a very nonlinear process, not least because you get spikes instead of a linear signal. But even if you think about the probability of making a spike, that's a very nonlinear function of your input signals, even in this system, which is relatively simple. In fact, it isn't even completely clear that it's a monotonic function, right? If you go too fast, the system doesn't respond. If you go too slow, nothing happens. So the mapping from here to here is complicated. So that suggests that the mapping backwards would be equally complicated. But that isn't always true. And the reason, I mean, we could do a calculation, but let me, again, do it intuitively. And the argument actually, it's nice because it was done here, well, actually, before this building was built, but here at ITP, by Tony Z and myself. The argument's following. If I what can one action potential tell me? Well, it tells me something about what happened in this neighborhood in time. Right? I figure the system doesn't have infinitely long memory. So when it makes a spike, it tells me something about what happened in the recent past. And so I could imagine then taking the, every time I see a spike, I look back at what happened. And I compute, for example, the average waveform. And then I say, look, when one spike happens, that's my best guess about what happened. I just take all the examples and average them. But now suppose that the next spike takes a very long time to come. Right? So the spikes are spaced very far apart. Then exactly what the form of this average is some terribly complicated thing that has to do with all the nonlinear rules that take signals and encode them in spikes. But if the spikes are very far apart, then the contribution of each spike to reconstructing the whole waveform has to come independently. Because there's no way for them to influence each other, right? If they think that the signal has a correlation time, and the spikes are very far apart compared to the correlation time, then anything that one spike tells you about isn't correlated with what the other spike tells you about. Yeah, there'll be in the extreme limit, there'll be areas where you just guess zero because you don't have any information. Now, the tricky question is, what happened? So that's easy in the limit the spikes are very far apart. And that's the answer, and that's actually the correct answer. The question is, what happens as they come closer together? Okay? In particular, if they come close enough together to fill in the holes, maybe this simple picture gets destroyed. So what Tony and I did was to look at some relatively simple models for the encoding process and show that, maybe the formal way to say it is that if I ask you, sorry, let me back up a second. So what did I just say? I said that it might be that what every spike gives you is independent of what every other spike gives you. And so then in that case, when one spike occurs, you lay down your little estimate of what happened in that neighborhood. And then the next time a spike occurs, you lay down another little template with that estimate, and you just add them up. And as Misha said, if the spikes are really very sparse, then there'll be lots of gaps. And the best thing you can do in the gap is guess zero, because positive and negative velocities are equally likely. Okay. Now, you might ask, can you do better than this? So if you have some model for how the code works, of course, you can just calculate what the best estimate is. Right? Because let's say you're trying to reconstruct something, reconstruct the signal to minimize chi squared, then what you have to do is just go through the calculation and figure out what's the best estimator in that sense. And what you're doing, if you start with something like this, is a kind of perturbation theory. You're saying that to first approximation, each spike makes an independent contribution, and then there could be a correction. Where pairs of spikes contribute, and so on. And so what you might want to do is to study in the context of some model what happens as the spikes get closer together on average. Right? So as we start to fill in the gaps, it turns out that two things happen. One, of course, is that these terms start to become important. Right? If the spikes start to get closer and closer together. But it's also true that if you look carefully in the model, then the function that you write down here also tends to narrow in time. Okay? And one way to think about this is that if you have more spikes, so suppose that the spikes form a Poisson process, right? Whose rate is being modulated by the signal in some complicated nonlinear way. That means there's a component of the response which is deterministic, namely the rate, and a component which is noisy, namely exactly where the spikes come. But the higher the average rate, the higher the signal-to-noise ratio. And the higher the signal-to-noise ratio, the more you can trust the signals at high frequencies. But usually the way you get around the noise is to average over time. And that's what this function is doing for you. It's smoothing everything out in time. But if the average firing rate is higher, the signal-to-noise ratio is higher, and you don't need to average as much. So this function actually narrows in time as the firing rates go up in some classes of models. Okay? And what that means is that the regime in which this linear term dominates is actually much larger than you would have guessed. Okay? So the lesson of the model calculation was that I could construct models for the encoding of signals in spike trains that have the property that linearity, the nonlinearities in encoding the signal, don't immediately force the decoding to be strongly nonlinear. That there's a regime where nonlinear encoding and linear decoding can coexist. Okay? Details don't matter, because the details are all wrong. Right? I mean, you make some particular model of how it works, and of course that model doesn't describe any real neuron. All the details are all wrong. So, of course, in any particular model, I can calculate what all these functions are, but I don't believe that describes any real neuron. But the lesson is that there's a class of models in which this linear decoding actually can work surprisingly well. So why don't we just try it, right? So now we'll switch hats, right? Instead of being a theorist calculating this lovely expansion, which we all, you know, I mean, what did you learn how to do in school? You learned how to do perturbation theory, right? So you suddenly realize it's very, very attractive, right? And of course you grind out all the terms. But eventually you realize this isn't the point. The point is that there's a broad situation in which this term dominates. And if that's true, then this problem's really simple. Because it says that I can just go through my experiment and try to fit something of this form, and I'll choose my function f to try to get these two things as close as possible. So I do an hour-long experiment, I take the first half hour, and I just figure out what function f to use so that I get the best fit between this estimate and the right answer, and then I look at the second half of the experiment and measure how well I do. Okay? And the problem of finding this function empirically is completely trivial, because you're trying to minimize the mean square error between this and the real signal, but that means the mean square error is then a quadratic functional of the function f, and quadratic functionals you can minimize by hand, right? So there's no complex optimization or local minima to worry about or anything else. It's just it's like regression, right? So the conclusion of the theoretical work was there's a regime in which decoding is no harder than regression. Of course, you don't know whether that regime applies to real neurons. And in fact, of course, I can take the same neuron and under one set of conditions this will work, and then I can push it so that in another set of conditions it doesn't work. But happily, there is a reason in a set of conditions which are just like this, except instead of only stepping the pattern, we let it jiggle around and essentially take a random walk, then this linear decoding works very well. And so what we did was we went back to experiments that Rob had done, and we were joined by two students, now all grown up, Fred Rieke and David Warland. I think Boris showed you some of Fred's experiments on photoreceptors. And we did this decoding, and what we found, in fact, was that when you sort of ground through all the details and asked yourself, how much noise is there in my estimate? Of course, that noise now has a power spectrum, right? Because it's a continuous signal. Then that noise was, again, within a factor of two of the generalization of this argument, right? So there's an obvious generalization of this argument to the continuous case. And then you find, again, that the noise level is within about a factor of two. Okay? So what that's telling you is that, first of all, it's kind of intriguing that we understand the structure of the code well enough that we can decode the signal so accurately, which might be a feature of having looked in a very simple parameter regime. So let's not make too big a deal out of it. But importantly, we understood the code well enough that we could decode the signal so that the accuracy of the estimates is within a factor of two of the limit that's imposed by noise in the photoreceptors and diffraction in the optics. Noise in the photoreceptors mostly being photon shot noise, but if you want to get the details right, you actually go and measure the signal noise characteristics of the photoreceptors. So What this tells you is that you have a system that is continuously and in real time estimating a feature of the signals in the outside world, namely motion. And the precision with which that's being done is very close to the limits that are imposed by the physics of the inputs. So what does that say about how the nervous system should do this task? In order to perform close to these physical limits, there's two things you have to do. One is, so think about having a movie camera, and there's some noise in the camera, and then you're going to build a box that's supposed to estimate motion of the camera, right? There's two points, right? One is the box itself had better not be too noisy, right? Because if the box that you use for doing the computation is very noisy, then obviously you can't reach the limit that's imposed by noise at the input, because your own internal noise will dominate. So you better be quiet. But that's actually not enough, right? Because the motion signals are not available in any linear combination of the photoreceptor signals. Right? You have to do a nonlinear operation in order to pull out something related to motion. And so when you do nonlinear operations, typically they're not invertible, right? And if you have noise in the system, then if you do the wrong nonlinear operation, you'll mix lots of the noise into your computation. So you not only have to be quiet, you also have to do the right nonlinear operations. So what are the right nonlinear operations in order to estimate motion? So one way of thinking about this question, let's stay intuitive. I'll tell you what the real calculation is in just a minute. So I want to find the right nonlinear operations, which are supposed to take me from photodetector signals to an estimate of motion. So how do I do it? Well, there's a trivial answer, which is that if you're looking at an image which is moving, right, then what you see is this thing on the screen, and it's translating, right? Or this thing in front of you is translating. So if you want to know how fast it's moving, then what you'd say is, well, look, theta dot, or x zero dot, is I just take the time derivative of the intensity and divide it by the spatial derivative, right, with a minus sign. It's trivial, right? There's only one problem. Well, actually, there are two problems. So if there's a little bit of noise in your signal, actually, if there were a lot of noise, it would be a very serious problem. But if there's some noise in your signal, and noise now might consist either of noise in the photodetectors, photon shot noise plus any excess noise that the photodetectors make, or it might include just things that are happening in the outside world that don't correspond to your own rigid body motions. So even though you're flying along at a couple of meters per second and rocking back and forth at 50 degrees per second, the world around you is actually, the wind's blowing, the leaves are moving, there's all sorts of stuff going on, right? So this isn't an exact model of the image that you're seeing. Might be in the laboratory an exact model, up to photoreceptor noise, but certainly in the outside world, it's not an exact model. Why is that a problem? Well, if you think about noise, you know that there's two things you should never do with a noisy signal. One is you should never differentiate it, because there's always more noise at high frequencies. And the other is you shouldn't divide by noisy signals, because there's a probability that you end up with zero in the denominator. And here you've done both. So this sounds like a good idea, but it's not robust to noise. So in a perfect world, this is what you should do. But in the real world, this can't be quite right. Now, it might be that the signal-to-noise ratios are rather high, and so this is almost right, but it can't be exactly right. What happens if you're in the other limit, right? So this is somehow what you should do if... This must be something about high signal-to-noise ratios, right? Maybe. Even then, we're a little worried that that's not good enough. But something like this works at the high signal-to-noise ratios. What happens at low signal-to-noise ratios? Well, now let's be a little more formal. What are we really doing? We're taking the photodetector signals and we're trying to estimate velocity. So what we'd like to do is to compute the probability of the velocity given a set of photodetector voltages. Well, how do I compute this probability distribution? Well, I use Bayes' rule, right? This is hard to do, right? Because usually what you think about is there are images in the outside world. Those get imaged onto the photodetectors. The photodetectors produce voltages in response. And what I'm asking you to do is to turn it around and say, I've shown you what the photodetector voltages are. Tell me what was going on in the outside world. So I use Bayes' rule. What I do is I compute the probability of the photodetector signals given that you're moving in a certain way. And I multiply that by the probability that you moved along that trajectory and normalize. So, it's Bayes' rule. This, everybody knows, right? This isn't a novelty, right? Okay. So now how do I do this? Well, this is a model of the trajectories that I take. So for example, in the lab, it might be basically a random walk. Although I could also think about doing this. I mean, people have filmed the trajectories that flies have taken, so I know something about what this distribution is supposed to look like. What about this? Well, I have a problem, right? Which is that motion doesn't change the voltage in the photoreceptors. What changes the motion in the photoreceptors is when more photons fall on them. So the pattern of light intensity as a function of space and time that falls on the animal's retina has something to do with motion, but it's not exactly the same. So what I have to think about is, suppose I lived in a world and I was moving completely straight. Well, then I would see some dynamics, right? The pattern of intensity as a function of space and time would have some form. And I'd describe it statistically. And then on top of that, I have my rigid body rotation. So what I know is that in the outside world, maybe I should think of there being the intensity as a function of space and time looks like this. That even if you were going straight so that x0 was fixed, there'd still be some dynamics. And then on top of that, you have this rocking motion. And so there's some probability distribution for the intensity as a function of space and time. And then, of course, there's also the probability distribution for your trajectory. And then what does the voltage in a photodetector look like? Well, let me not worry for the moment. Of course, photoreceptors average over a little window in time, but let me not worry about it just to keep things simple. They average over some window in space. I don't know, let's call it the aperture. Right? And then there's noise. And the noise has photon shot noise in it. And it also has excess noise that you have to characterize empirically. Because the photodetectors are not perfect photon counters. They're very good, but they're not perfect. The aperture, of course, is just determined by the optics. which again we understand. So this actually is a model for this, right? So what this is telling you is that this is the average part of the photoreceptor signal, and there's some noise. And the noise is, to a good approximation, Gaussian. So what this means then is that the thing I want to compute is the probability of the photoreceptor signals given the trajectory of motion. But what I know is that if I told you the intensity, right, then I would have told you basically the average photodetector signal, and there would be noise. So there's a term which is something like so if there was just photon shot noise, then the fluctuations around this mean would just have a spectral density, which was the photon counting rate. Okay, that's the probability of the photoreceptor voltages given the trajectory, right? I'll remind you that x0 dot is the thing that we call theta dot. But the problem is that I don't know I. Right? I'm trying to estimate my motion, but I actually don't know what I'm looking at. I'm using my photoreceptor signals to estimate motion, but my only knowledge of what I look at also comes from my photoreceptor signals. So I don't have any independent way of knowing what the pattern is on the screen or what the images are in the outside world. So actually, in order to do this right, you have to average over all possible movies you could be seeing, weighted by the appropriate probability distribution. Okay? And then this goes into this Bayesian picture. And then if you want to know what your best estimate is, you compute the conditional mean, because that's the one that minimizes chi-squared. Right. So you average over the functions I of x and t, and they have buried inside them this velocity. Well, conceptually, you can imagine what life would have looked like if you'd flown straight. Right. So what Mark Potters and I did, so let me just write down the last step, which is that your estimate is this, right? And you all know that this is the conditional mean, so it minimizes chi squared between theta dot and theta dot estimate. Okay? You all know that theorem, right? If you want to build the best estimator in the least square sense, you always compute the conditional mean. So, so this is a mess, right? But that's really what you should do if you want to, if you actually want to make use of all of the information in the photodetectors, you have to do this integral. So, you know, flies are really smart, but they probably don't do functional integrals. In fact, we don't do them that well either, because we only know how to do two things, right? There's only two ways to do functional integrals. One is by perturbation theory, and one is by searching for semi-classical solutions, right? So you can do perturbation theory and you can do saddle points. And there really isn't much else. Unless you find some coordinate transformation that makes it exactly solvable. Trust me, we looked. So Mark Potter's thesis was to try and play with this problem. The difficulty, of course, the real difficulty, is here. So as Misha pointed out, you know, how do you average over all the movies you would have seen if you'd been flying straight? Well, conceptually, I know what I mean, but what probability distribution am I supposed to put here? I have no idea, right? It's a complicated question. So what we tried to do was try various possibilities and see whether some of the results are independent to some extent of what distribution you put here. So the one that's most independent of the distribution you put here is what happens if the signal-to-noise ratio is small. If the signal-to-noise ratio is small, then that means that, I mean, this is the signal, right? So if the signal-to-noise ratio is small, you should do perturbation theory in this term. And what you find is that the first non-vanishing term is quadratic, which is actually not that surprising. And of course, if you make some assumptions about what this thing looks like, you can compute the kernel that goes in here. So what is this telling you? It's telling you that if signal noise ratios are very low, then the way that you estimate how fast something's moving is you look at the signal that this photodetector gets, and you look at the signal that a nearby photodetector gets at a slightly different time, and you correlate them. And if they're correlated, then that means that whatever was here was sort of over here a little while earlier or later. And that means something's moving. On the other hand, if all you have is random flicker on the screen, then for a moment in time, you might find that these signals are the same. But when you average over the whole area or over a window of time, all those correlations will go away. Okay. So what this says is that you should estimate motion by computing a correlation. Now, this is not a discovery, at least not a discovery of ours, it turns out. So this says that it turns out that this actually goes back to Reichardt and Hachenstein in the 1950s. They were respectively a physics student and a biology student, and vowed to each other that if they made it through the war, they would do something together. And they did. And they actually studied, so the problem was to find some nervous system they could study quantitatively with the extra constraint that there was zero money. So they studied, Reichardt eventually went on and did a lot of work in flies, but they actually started in beetles. This very beautiful series of behavioral experiments that showed that the beetles' perception of motion really was based on a kind of correlation between signals at different space-time points. And they knew, of course, that there was a lattice of photodetectors in the compound eye, so they could exploit this to try to produce signals that went to one photodetector and then the next one, and see if they could get how things depended on these signals. And they had this picture that you were computing motion by doing correlations. Now, yes?
That's not important in the very beginning, because we end up at this point with all these integrals. So it's the lowest approximation to this.
Yes, so, right. So the point is that historically, what they did was to show that there is a regime in which that describes the behavior. So they looked at the behavior and made a model and said this was how it worked. Now, what we're claiming here is that actually there is a regime in which that's the optimal strategy. You just can't do any better if the signal-to-noise ratios are low. Right, so now,
if you want to go to quantum moments, these probabilities, you're estimating them.
Right, okay, so what we're, Okay, so what we're saying is, so let's take the steps one at a time. What we're saying is that generically, for any probability distributions, the at low signal-to-noise ratios, the form of the optimal estimator is this correlation form, and the thing that you don't know is exactly what this kernel is. So let me just skip and tell you a fact about the visual system, which is that this kernel adapts. Okay, so maybe we don't need to know a priori exactly what it is, because the system can adjust it. Okay? But more importantly, one of the nice things about this is that it tells you something quite surprising. You see, this is a very strange way to estimate motion, because remember that the voltages are, roughly speaking, linear in the light intensity modulation. So this means that if I take the pattern on the screen and double the contrast, my estimate of the motion of the velocity should change by a factor of 4, because it's quadratic. It seems like a terrible thing to do. You're making a big systematic error. But remember that whenever you try to estimate something in the presence of noise, there's always a trade-off between systematic errors and random errors. So for example, if we go back to the simple problem of averaging to take out noise, you know that when you average, you always lose a little bit of the signal, systematically. There's some high-frequency stuff that was there in the signal that isn't in the averaged version. That's a systematic error. The point, of course, is that there's also a lot of noise that you threw away, so you reduced your random error at the expense of a little bit of systematic error, and there's a best balance point, and that's what matched filtering is called. Right? That's what's called matched filtering, when you choose that integration time just right. So there's a similar thing going on here that somehow when you do this balancing act between the systematic errors and the random errors, the balance comes out that at low signal-to-noise ratios, you should do this funny thing of just computing correlations, which makes you very susceptible to a very peculiar kind of systematic error. So let me very quickly tell you what the evidence is that this actually happens. So first of all, if you just look at the firing rate of motion-sensitive neurons, then if you make very low contrast signals and you move at constant velocity, you find that the firing rate varies quadratically with the contrast, even though the velocity is constant. So you have a neuron that's supposed to be sensitive to motion, but with the motion held constant, it's actually being modulated by contrast in precisely this way. Okay, first point. You can do a similar thing with fly behavior. Then you can do something else, which you can do either with the fly or with us. By the way, the statement about motion-sensitive neurons being contrast-dependent at low contrasts, that's true in monkeys too. Okay? It doesn't have anything to do with what species you're looking at. This says that if I can produce a signal that has the right space-time correlations in it, then when you run it through a device that does this, you will conclude that there is a velocity, even if there is no object moving in the pattern, right? All I have to do is make sure that when you compute this correlation function, on average, you get a non-zero answer. So in fact, what I can do is to make a movie that is done the following way. So I know how to make a movie. I take the screen, I divide it into pixels, and on every frame of the movie, I roll the dice and update every single pixel with a random number. It's spatiotemporal white noise. And then I take that movie, the whole movie, and I displace it in time, and I displace it in position by a small amount. And then with a certain amplitude A, I add it back to what I had originally. Now, if you think about the correlation function, no, because you add it back.
You add it,
right? And so what happens is then that if you think about the core, so if these are Gaussian random numbers, then this is a Gaussian stochastic process. And so it's completely described by its correlation function. And the correlation function is translation invariant, both in space and in time. So let me think about the x minus x prime, t minus t prime plane. What does the correlation function look like for this process? Well, if I don't have this here, it's just white noise. So there's a delta function there. When I compute the correlation function here, there's the term of this with itself, which goes back here. There's the term of this with itself that also goes back here. And then there's the cross term. And the cross term produces two things here at delta t and delta x, and of course the symmetric one. And if you work it out, if this delta t and delta x are within the range of this kernel, and you run this process through here, you'll see it move. And you do. Okay? If you make these movies in which there's no object moving, you see it move, and it's very robust. Okay? And the fly does too. And in fact, you can fiddle with these things to map out what the form of this kernel is, and actually show that the fly is computing motion by comparing the neighbors on this hexagonal lattice. It's very gorgeous. Even more dramatic is, so you might say, well, look, this isn't testing very much. Because if I had something that was moving rigidly, then then the correlation function would all lie on a line, which was here, whose slope would determine the velocity. So what you've done is to just shrink the whole line of correlations to a couple of points. So maybe I really have this very sophisticated strategy that's looking for the whole line, and you put some power on the line, and that's what I detected. Okay. Change the sign of A. There's still power on the line, right? I haven't moved anything. I haven't changed the velocity that you would get by trying to fit a line to these points. However, if you really believe that this is what you're computing, the cross term has changed sign. If you do this and flip the sign of A, you see it move the other way. I mean, it's very vivid, okay? So does the fly. So there's no question, I think, that at low signal-to-noise ratios, which you can get to by low contrast, low photon flux, the system does something like this. What's interesting is to ask what happens as you leave this limit. So this is encouraging, but we're still not done. And I will finish by 12:30. We're not done because I said this is, I mean, we did perturbation theory, right? So I'm telling you what the leading term looks like. But what if, when you actually plug in real numbers, the next term's bigger, right? That's actually hard to do, as people are pointing out. You know, you don't really know what this distribution looks like. So maybe this is a nice story, but you should worry that this should work only for contrast of 0.0001%. And in fact, it works for contrast up to a few percent. So yeah, low signal-to-noise ratio, but it seems to be working at signal-to-noise ratios, you know, 4 orders of magnitude larger than what you called low. So hang on to that question for a second. Let's ask, how do you leave this regime? What happens as the signal-to-noise ratio gets higher? Well, as the signal-to-noise ratio gets higher, then you might hope that this integral over I would be dominated by its saddle point. And so what we did was to go to that limit, and now you have to assume something about the form of this distribution, but you can make some fairly general assumptions, which we could talk about. And what happens as you go to high signal-to-noise ratio is that your estimate starts to look something like this. First of all, if signal noise ratios are high, then you don't need to average over time, right? So you expect that this business of having kernels that are time dependent is going to fall away if the signal noise ratio is high enough. So what you get looks something like this, where A is some number. So this is a little hard to interpret because, you know, you're on a discrete lattice and everything. So let me remind you. This looks like this, okay? You're taking the intensity signal, of course, as represented by the voltage, taking its derivative in time, weighting it by derivatives in space, averaging over space, and then normalizing by the squared derivative in space. Okay? Now you'll notice that if the images are reasonably uniform and the intensities are very big, then this constant drops out. And that looks something like that. So what you get is that at high signal-to-noise ratios, you cross over to computing something which starts to look a lot like this ratio of derivatives, except it's insulated against the little leftover bits of noise by doing this spatial averaging. And of course, you weight your spatial average by those places where there's actually some gradient in the contrast that gives you a feature to hang on to. So obviously, places where the intensity varies very slowly in space are not strong contributors to your estimate of motion. So what's neat here is, and what you can actually show, you'll notice that what's in the numerator here is a quadratic form. But the low signal-to-noise ratio limit is also a quadratic form. So what you can actually show is that this is that with smooth continuation as a function of the photon counting rate. So if you think about computing this functional integral, there's no phase transition, right? It's a smooth function of the photon counting rate. And so you go smoothly from a limit in which you do something correlator-like to something gradient-like. And so what's the simplest corollary of this? It says that if I look as a function of image contrast at my estimate of the velocity, then if I'm trapped at low contrasts, then either in this formula or in that one, everything's going to be quadratic. But eventually, if there's enough photon flux, I'll get to a contrast that's big enough, the signal-to-noise ratios are high, and the behavior will look like this, which is eventually gradient-like and independent of contrast. So you get something like this, where although you're saturated with respect to contrast, this point, of course, still moves up and down with the real velocity, because now you're actually estimating the velocity. If you lower the photon flux, then getting to high signal-to-noise ratio is harder. You need more contrast. So to get to lower photon flux, then this correlator regime gets larger. And actually, it's even a little more subtle. If you live in a world where the typical contrasts are larger, then this thing also changes. So the form of this input-output relation depends not only on the photon flux, but on the typical contrast in your environment. Well, if you put here, instead of estimated velocity, you just put the firing rate of the motion-sensitive neurons, this is exactly what happens. Okay. The worry is still that this all makes sense, but the crossover could be in the wrong place. So it's very hard to count. It's qualitatively, the fact that it's quadratic down here crosses over to being constant up here, that it has to move in this way, this is all completely clear from the calculation. It's very hard to estimate exactly where this crossover point should be, because that depends on the structure of the distributions. So what Rob has done recently, and this is where I'm going to stop, is a really gorgeous thing, which is that, you know, instead of asking your theoretical friends to compute these integrals with probability distributions that they're supposed to guess at, you could go measure the damn distributions and compute the integrals by Monte Carlo, right? That is to say, you pull lots of samples out and just compute what you want. So what do? You take a bicycle helmet, and you mount on the bicycle helmet an array of photodetectors and a gyroscope. And so now you have image as a function of space and time, and you also have your angular velocity. And you take a walk, or jog, or ride your bike, or whatever you want. And so you now have a large sample of image intensity as a function of space and time, and the angular velocity signal. And so, for example, you can ask, how do I actually combine spatial and temporal gradients to get the velocity? So what I do is, let me see if I can get this right. I go through my data, and I just sample what are the spatial and temporal gradients. And then every time I see a certain combination of spatial and temporal gradients, I go figure out what the velocity was, and I average, right? And now that's the conditional mean of the velocity given the visual inputs. And so that's my optimal estimator. And what does it look like? Well, what you might guess is that this is a high velocity. It's a low velocity, right? And so you should get a set of fanned out lines, and of course, their appropriate reflections in the other quadrants, right? But what is this telling you? This is telling you that if the signals are really big, then that's the right answer. But if the spatial gradients get to be small, then as the spatial gradient gets smaller and smaller, if it looks like this, then the velocity goes up, right? So if I think about coming in this direction, then as the spatial gradient gets smaller, because it's in the denominator of my estimate, the velocity goes up. So that corresponds, right, to going from a low velocity to higher and higher velocities. Except, of course, that at some point, the spatial gradients become so small that this term drops out. And now I have the spatial gradient in the numerator. And so smaller spatial gradients correspond to smaller velocities. So let's see if I can draw this correctly. If I'm coming in here, right, I want the velocity to get bigger and bigger and bigger. But then at some point, the velocities have to start getting smaller again. And the only way that can happen is if these curves actually do this. Right? They can't cross, of course, but. Right? So those are constant curves of constant velocity in this picture. And if this picture, right, this is just a transcription of this theory to a different representation. And if this is actually the right answer, then the scale over here has to be such that it will explain these data. That is to say, it has to be a scale like this. Okay. So what Rob's done is to take this jog through the woods with this funny helmet on, and actually sample these probability distributions of velocity and gradients. and map out these curves, which happily look exactly, well, they look as theory predicts, which is not exactly what I drew, but they look very nice. And then what you can do is just take this model, right? You now have a model of how to compute velocity given your spatial and temporal gradients. And then take your favorite image, which you're moving at constant velocity, and run it through this device and ask what it looks like as a function of contrast on this picture. And you find that the crossover point is indeed in a regime where real animals are still sort of sloshing back and forth doing correlator-like and gradient-like computations. So the correlator behavior is in here, right? Because constant velocity means constant product. So you have these, hyperbolic curves. Whereas out here, constant velocity means constant ratio. So you have these fan things, right? And the crossover is smooth. So we're not completely convinced that we can do it all quantitatively yet, but there's no question that real world signals have this crossover from correlator to ratio of derivative behavior in a regime which is close to the regime where real neurons do it. Okay? We know we're still arguing about all the factors. And actually, it's even more than that, because you'll notice that when you come, that this is a picture in which you're local in space, right? You take a gradient in space and a derivative in time at one point. If you want to integrate what happens from multiple points in space, you have to do it correctly. If you just average the results, then you reduce the random errors, but the systematic errors stay the same. And remember, the whole point here is that there's a trade-off between random and systematic errors, and it's a nonlinear problem. And so you'll notice that when you integrate over space, this is not equivalent to a local estimate, which is averaged. And so you can show that the improvement in performance depends critically on the fact that you don't average a local estimator. Which means that if you think about the visual system as computing motion in small units and then bringing those signals together, it can't just average them if it wants to get optimal performance. It has to have some other signal that tells it how to normalize these things. And there's a lot of evidence for that, both in insect visual systems and in the monkey visual system. So what I hope that this part has shown you is that you can sort of start with basically the physical limits of signal and noise at the input. You find that the system really does perform close to those limits. And if you ask yourself, what kinds of computations does the system need to do in order to accomplish that task at that level of precision? The answer is not completely trivial, right? There are different regimes to the computation. The crossover between them is complicated. The details of how you cross over have to be adaptive. It depends on the environment that you live in. And it would seem that the system actually manages to do all these things. Okay? And it's particularly pleasing because the proponents of correlator-based motion estimation and gradient-based motion estimation were at each other's throats for a decade or more. Okay? And I think the right answer is that the optimal strategy is to go smoothly from one to the other, depending on conditions, and it seems like the visual system is actually capable of doing that. So this was all about estimating motion, and now when we come back after lunch, we'll talk about the problem of encoding the signal. And there, the notion of performance will be sort of how much information do you manage to capture, and how efficiently do you manage to write it down. Okay, so at 2, right?